I next met with Dr. Javier Cortez, another major research figure in HER2-positive disease, and to begin, we chatted about the HER2 dimerization-inhibiting antibody pertuzumab.
When we started to study pertuzumab based on some preclinical models showing that maybe in tumor cells with no overexpression of HER2, so low-expressing tumors, there may be a role just by blocking the dimerization. So we decided to run a randomized phase 2 clinical trial with two doses of pertuzumab in HER2 non-overexpressing tumors. So we used monotherapy. We did observe that the activity of pertuzumab was tremendously low. So we decided not to move forward. And I was with Jose Baselga, and we were discussing about what happened there. And we talked to the people from Roche. And listen, so we might explore this in patients with HER2-positive disease, maybe a small cohort of patients, to see if there is something there in trastuzumab-resistant patients. So this is why we decided to run a two-stage Simon design phase 2 trial with pertuzumab. Patients who were progressing on trastuzumab, we just combined with pertuzumab. We observed beautiful activity there, tremendous, very, very nice partial and some complete responses. And what we decided to do afterwards is say, listen, why do we have this activity? Just because of pertuzumab or just because of the combination of both agents? So we treated a small number of patients, 27 patients, I think, with pertuzumab alone in trastuzumab-resistant patients. Again, pertuzumab alone did not work. And we reintroduced trastuzumab afterwards, and we observed responses. So this is the story, how pertuzumab started to be used in HER2-positive disease. And from here, you know the rest of the story. We designed the CLEOPATRA trial, and that's it.
Yeah, you know, I interviewed Dr. Baselga recently, and I said, you know, I was kind of surprised when I first saw the CLEOPATRA results of the magnitude of the benefit. And he said, well, we weren't.
No, you know what happens is that the activity we observed in this phase 2 was also amazing. So when you have such a great activity in trastuzumab-resistant patients, something good should have happened also in the metastatic disease.
Before we get into the actual clinical trial data, at a mechanistic level, why do you think there is so much benefit, and where does the immune system fit into this?
Well, that's a very good point. So I am not sure if the tremendous activity of the combination of both agents is because of the immune system. I'm pretty sure it is playing a role. But how much role does it play compared to other mechanistic issues? Well, this is something I do not know. For example, we know that the immune response is playing a role there, but also the dimerization blocket, I think, is tremendously important. So I think that both mechanisms of action might play a role together. So which is more important? We do not know. But, you know, with the Neosphere data presented last year, I guess, by Luca Gianni, showing that patients with some, let's say, immune signature in general, so these patients benefit more or less from pertuzumab-based therapy in combination with trastuzumab.
You're talking about the neoadjuvant.
The neoadjuvant, yeah. I'm talking about the Neosphere trial, the neoadjuvant setting. But this is the most beautiful study in terms of immune or immunological issues regarding which patients benefit more or less. So I think the immune system is playing a role, but we still do not know how to identify which patients are going to be treated with pertuzumab based on immune-related issues.
So before we get into the actual CLEOPATRA data, I'm just kind of curious because there's so much excitement at this meeting about immune-based therapy, particularly anti-PD-1 and ipilimumab. Any thoughts about whether this is going to fit into the equation in breast cancer?
There are, at this time, ongoing small phase 2 clinical trials, some of them with ipilimumab and other one with PD-L1. I think it's too early to discuss about the activity of these agents. But what's clear is that the immune system might play a role not only in melanoma, not only in renal cell carcinoma, not only in breast cancer, but also in many other tumor types. Lung cancer is an example of those. I mean, PD-L1 might work very well in patients with lung cancer. So what we have to try to do is to identify which patients might benefit more or less from these approaches. By sure, we have some patients also with breast cancer which might be benefited from immune therapeutic agents.
Can you go back and talk a little bit about, first of all, what was looked at in the Neosphere study neoadjuvantly, and then what was seen and looked at in CLEOPATRA?
You mean in terms of activity or toxicity? Or?
Yeah, with the design of the study and what was seen.
Yeah. We have many, many clinical trials in the neoadjuvant setting looking at pertuzumab, looking at lapatinib, looking at trastuzumab, looking at combination of these agents. And what is amazing is that in general, the majority, if not all the trial, shows at least numerically higher pathological complete responses with double blockade. And many of them also are clearly statistically significant difference. So I think that, and this is something we have observed also in the metastatic disease. So when we combine two agents, because we are optimizing and we are maybe avoiding these early mechanisms of resistance for trastuzumab, when we combine both agents, we are clearly enhancing the activity to treat our patients.
Yeah, I'm kind of curious. It seems, you know, the NEOSPHERE study did show an increased path CR rate. I mean, it doesn't seem like very much additional toxicity, if any. And yet, I really haven't seen people using that strategy, neoadjuvant therapy. Do you use it? Would you like to use it? Is it a regulatory thing?
Yeah, that's an excellent point. So the point here is that, unfortunately, at this time, this strategy, just pertuzumab with trastuzumab or lapatinib with trastuzumab, have not been approved based on regulatory issues. So we are still waiting for the adjuvant trials. So what I think is that once the adjuvant trials became positive, and they will be positive, I'm pretty sure about that, we will use it in the new adjuvant setting. So what is also amazing is that there is a subset of patients treated only with target agents with a pathological response. What is amazing is that this year at ASCO, when we look at which patient benefit more or less, it seems that patients with HER2-positive disease, HER2-enriched subtype, have a tremendously higher rate of pathological complete responses. So maybe we have to start try to optimize which patients do not need chemotherapy to try to optimize the strategy.
Any thoughts about who those patients might be?
Okay, so according to the PAM50 platform, maybe those patients with HER2-enriched tumors. So the point here is to identify which tumors clearly depend on HER2. So, you know, this is like a lion. If you just cut off the teeth of the lion, at the end, this is not a lion, nevermore. So this is the problem with the HER2-positive tumors. Are all of them clearly depending on HER2? That's not very well known. But the HER2-enriched...
Now, what do you mean by HER2-enriched? Like high amplification?
No, I mean with the classical subtypes of breast cancers, according to the genomic profiling, there are a group of about 70% of patients with HER2-positive disease belong to the category of HER2-enriched tumors. So the genes involved in HER2 are activated. Okay, so these are genomic subtyping. So no based in immunohistochemistry. I'm talking about genes. So this subgroup of patients might benefit more from these therapies.
Interesting. From a practical clinical point of view, can you talk about what we've learned from the CLEOPATRA trial? Now you've presented data looking at survival, quality of life. Can you kind of bring us up to date on what we've learned from that study?
Yeah, this is amazing. This is amazing. I mean, what we have learned is that when we combine pertuzumab with trastuzumab-based therapy, we clearly increase outcomes. And we increase all outcomes, you know. I mean, we increase PFS, we increase overall response rate, we increase overall survival, and we optimize also quality of life. And this is achieved with a really, really, really low toxicity. So what is amazing here is that if we have a look at the hazard ratio of survival, it seems that the hazard ratio is higher than the hazard ratio we obtained with trastuzumab in the first pivotal trial, the Dennis Lehmann pivotal trial published in New England 2001. So it seems that the benefit of adding pertuzumab to trastuzumab is even greater than the benefit of just adding trastuzumab to chemotherapy.
That's interesting. I never even thought about it. What was the original hazard ratio?
So chemo trastuzumab versus chemo, hazard ratio for overall survival 0.80.
Really? And that's not that high, not that low. And then what was the additional bump with pertuzumab that you just reported?
Pertuzumab trastuzumab chemo versus trastuzumab chemo It is about, I think we have to check it, but I think it's like more or less 0.64, 0.66, 0.68. So, you know, this is amazing. So the benefit we are obtaining with pertuzumab is even greater than the benefit we obtain with trastuzumab.
So I asked you to bring a case from your practice with HER2-positive disease. How about this 63-year-old lady with lung mets after receiving prior adjuvant treatment?
This was a 63-year-old woman with a more or less 3 centimeters on her left breast without any significant medical history. And the initial diagnosis was infiltrating ductal carcinoma, grade 3, ERPR negative, HER2-positive disease. So she underwent, at that time, lumpectomy and sentinel lymph node, and the pathology revealed 3 centimeters of cancer and 4 lymph nodes were involved. So we decided to administer 4 cycles of AC, followed by paclitaxel trastuzumab, followed by trastuzumab up to 1 year, and radiation therapy. So 2 years after completing adjuvant trastuzumab, the patient developed mild non-productive cough. So we performed a chest X-ray observing 2 pulmonary nodules, 2 lung metastases. So we did, with a PET scan at that time, I don't remember the reason for that, because I think that a CT scan would have been enough. But the patient did do a PET scan, known bone mets, known liver mets, but we observed those clear lung metastases. 1.5 and 1.9 centimeters.
Could I ask before you go on, you mentioned she got AC followed by paclitaxel trastuzumab, and I'm curious what your thoughts are about the chemo partner in the adjuvant setting nowadays. There's been a lot of debate about that, obviously in terms of anthracyclines.
Yeah, that's a very good point. So DJ Ratasco also, and this is something we have previously known, it seems that when you compare anthracyclines followed by paclitaxel, let's say anthracyclines followed by taxanes trastuzumab versus anthracyclines trastuzumab followed by taxanes trastuzumab, it seems that the pathological response is not increased. So I think that in general, and this is, I think it is in general common practice, specifically in the adjuvant setting, when we use trastuzumab, we usually started with anthracyclines and we continue on taxanes and trastuzumab. Another option could be the well-known TCH, docetaxel, carboplatin, and trastuzumab. So I think that this is also very used in Europe, but in my opinion, I do not have any prospective clinical data to definitely answer this question, but in my opinion, if you have a look at the Dennis Lemon trial in the adjuvant setting, the anthracyclines and trastuzumab-based therapy is approximately 2%, the curves are 2% higher or upper regarding to the TCH. So if we do not have specific cardio safety issues or whatever, I prefer to use anthracyclines followed by taxanes and trastuzumab-based therapy if possible.
Would have been lower risk situations, no negative.
So that's a very good point. So how do we find low risk in node negative tumors? So it is based on the tumor size or is it based on biology? So I think we have to combine everything. So, for example, I have discussed at ASCO this year how to optimize therapy for tumors T1A, T1B, N0 based on biology. So I think that there are, by sure, some very tiny tumors which might benefit from chemotherapy. And there are some larger tumors, even T2, T3, which are not going to benefit from chemotherapy. So I think that we have to combine everything: patient, the tumor, the biology, and the activity of the systemic therapies we have to decide which is the best options for our patients.
So could you describe a situation where you would maybe not use an anthracycline in a younger patient without cardiac disease?
Yeah. For example, I think that tiny tumors, let's say T1B or maybe T1C tumor, but T1B tumor, even triple negative, let's imagine a tumor of 6-7 millimeters, KC7, 20, 25, maybe 45 years old, I would use chemotherapy. Maybe DC or docetaxel plus cyclophosphamide 4 cycles could be a good option for these patients.
Interesting. So let's continue on with this patient.
Sure. So this patient has progressed in the lungs. We get a 5-needle aspiration biopsy, and the patient was positive for metastatic ductal carcinoma. We confirmed HER2 positivity, and we decided to use vinorelbine plus trastuzumab at first line. We have to remember that pertuzumab is not available at this time in Spain. It has been approved in Europe, but it is not reimbursed in Spain yet. And nevertheless, this patient came to our hospital before having the results of the Cleopatra trial. So maybe today we have been used a pertuzumab trastuzumab-based therapy. But at that time, we hadn't, and we used trastuzumab plus vinorelbine. So maybe we can ask ourselves two or three different questions. First, after progression to vinorelbine trastuzumab, which is the next option? Second, if we have had this patient today, would have we used vinorelbine trastuzumab or not?
Any comments on T-DM1?
Well, T-DM1 is a great drug. T-DM1 is trastuzumab plus chemo, but T-DM1 is a drug which is optimizing the chemo deliver. So the great point with T1 is that when it has been compared with the standard of care lapatinib and capecitabine, it did not only prolong PFS and survival, but it also decreased toxicity. So I think that that's amazing, you know, because I do not remember many clinical trials which have shown to improve outcomes, decreasing toxicity.
What about the thought of combining T-DM1 and pertuzumab? Obviously, that's being looked at in clinical trials, the MARIANNE study. Is that a regimen that you think is something that, if it could be paid for right now, you'd want to see a patient receive?
Well, I think it's very interesting to observe what happened in MARIANNE trial with this arm, because we have one phase 1-2 trial which showed interesting activity. But the point here is that the median progression-free survival in the CLEOPATRA trial with trastuzumab and pertuzumab was more than 18 months. The expected median progression-free survival with T-DM1 alone, based on the Hurvitz trial, the randomized phase 2 trial, was like more or less 14 months. So if we have pertuzumab-based therapy, 18 months, and we administer T-DM1 afterwards, the Sunil Verma trial published in the New England Journal of Medicine, the Amelia trial, showing more or less 9 months of PFS. So pertuzumab followed by T-DM1 is more or less offering a 27, 28, more or less 29 months of median progression-free survival. So if we combine upfront T-DM1 plus pertuzumab, do you think that we are going to have such an interesting median progression-free survival time? So in other words, do you think that T-DM1 plus pertuzumab can be the new standard of care versus pertuzumab followed by T-DM1? So this is not only a clinical trial to compare T-DM1 pertuzumab versus T-DM1. The point is that pertuzumab is also there. So I don't know. Let's see the data and let's discuss maybe all the time with the data of the MARIANNE trial.
Let's talk a little bit about HER2 negative disease. And I know you've been very involved in the trial that was reported at San Antonio comparing eribulin to capecitabine. And there's some more data being presented at ASCO that you're presenting. Can you go back and talk about what that trial looked at and what we've learned from it?
Sure. So what we have shown with eribulin is that eribulin is a new anti-MEK tool agent which has shown to increase survival in late line versus what we, the physicians, thought was the best choice for our patients. So it's called the treatment efficient choice. So eribulin was there, eribulin improved outcomes, improved overall survival, and it has been considered one of the standard of care in that setting. So because of this activity, we also wanted to try to move the drug into earlier lines of therapy. So in patients who have been pretreated with anthracycline and taxanes, maybe one of the most reasonable standard of care is capecitabine. We should not forget that capecitabine has been approved in that setting based on phase 2 trials. But it is there. It is there. So we decided to run a clinical trial comparing eribulin versus the standard of care, capecitabine, in that setting. And what we observed was that although the primary endpoint was not achieved, so eribulin did not improve survival or progression-free survival, both were co-primary endpoints of that trial. Numerically, the hazard ratio and the median overall survival favored the eribulin arm. And when we analyzed two issues this year at ASCO, when we analyzed the subgroup analysis and when we analyzed the quality of life data, we realized that in patients with HER2 negative disease and also in patients with triple negative disease, and even was better than capecitabine. And the quality of life, the global health status, also favored eribulin. So what am I going to say with that? The trial was negative, that's clear.
Well, you know, when you say the trial was negative, I wonder about that because I understand that the hope was that it would be better. But to me, the fact that it might have been equivalent, it looked fairly similar to a CAPE. Can you conclude that it was equivalent?
No, that's a very good point. But the trial was not designed as a non-inferiority trial. It was designed for superiority trial. So the point here is that when you design a clinical trial with one clear endpoint, we cannot conclude with other endpoints. So if we run a superiority clinical trial, we cannot say it is not inferior because it was not designed for that purpose. This is from a regulatory point of view, this is from a statistical point of view, but from a clinical point of view. I mean, for us as clinicians, in my opinion, eribulin is as good as or better than capecitabine, mostly in HER2 negative disease. So if you're asking me, if I have a patient with triple negative disease in second line, would I use eribulin? If I can do it, I would say yes. If I can, I would use it. But of course, if it is not approved, I will have to wait until the third line, where it's formally approved.
Again, I like the thought of clinical assessment. And you know, a lot of times quality of life, toxicity, data is one thing. It's another when you see patients in front of you. How do you compare just globally, clinically, the risk-benefit issues of these two drugs?
Well, yeah.
Because capecitabine is not always an easy drug either.
Right, but in general, it is a friendly drug. But you're right, there are some patients, for example, we have between 15 to 20% of patients with grade 3 Hedgehog syndrome, and that's not easy to manage. You have to decrease the dose, etc. And the point in the eribulin trial is that the doses of CAP were the highest ones, the doses which has been approved. And when we compare the quality of life, we observed that with both agents, the quality of life of the patients were improved, but the quality of life was improved statistically significantly better with eribulin than with capecitabine.
How much of that do you think was because of anti-tumor efficacy as opposed to toxicity?
Yeah, that's a very good point. I think that both issues are important because when we specifically look at the quality of life based on specific toxic adverse events very well known by both of these agents, you observed that the specific quality of life issues, for example, regarding hair loss or whatever, was better with capecitabine, and the quality of life based on GI problems, gastrointestinal problems, for example, was better for eribulin. But globally, in total, eribulin was better than CAP in terms of quality of life.
What else do you see from a clinical point of view in terms of toxicity with eribulin besides alopecia and myelosuppression?
Yeah, no, I think that first myelosuppression is not a big issue for patients. If they do not have febrile neutropenia, they even do not realize about the neutropenia. So I think this is not an issue. Alopecia is an important problem to take into account, but we should not forget that the patients have metastatic disease, and they are going to die, unfortunately. So it is important, but this should not be a major issue. But having said that, the most important problems with eribulin is maybe neurotoxicity, which has been observed in 8%, I'm talking about grade 3, 4, 8% in the EMERGE trial, but only in 4% of patients in the 301 trial. So compared with other anti-microtubule agents, maybe weekly paclitaxel, by far exaepilone, I think this is a very, very, very friendly drug.
Any interest in the research community about moving eribulin up earlier?
Yeah, we are conducting at this time clinical trials for that purpose. We have in our hospital, in our cooperative group in Spain, a very beautiful clinical trial in the neoadjuvant setting with eribulin alone, try to identify which patients benefit more. This year in ACR, it was shown that eribulin might have other mechanisms of action, very interestingly. And let's see if we can observe this in our neoadjuvant trial.
Another question related to HER2 negative, really triple negative disease, is the question of PARP inhibitors. I saw that you published work looking at the question of PI3 kinase inhibitors plus PARP inhibitors. Can you talk about that strategy?
So let me start with the PARP inhibitor story. So we all know the story of iniparib. Iniparib is called PARP inhibitor, although we know today that this is not a real PARP inhibitor. We do not know how it works very well. But we know the exciting results published in the New England Journal of Medicine by Joyce Sonsi and colleagues, showing that carboplatin, gem, and gemcitabine, gem, and iniparib improved clearly outcomes versus chemotherapy alone. But when we ran the phase 3, these data were not the same, and the overall survival was not increased with inipanib. So after that, there have been a tremendous debate about PARP inhibitor. And today we know that PARP inhibitors might have a very important role in BRCA tumors. So it is going to be launched some phase 3 clinical trials with PARP inhibitors in BRCA tumors, not in triple negative, in BRCA tumors, and let's see the data. So I think that PARP inhibitors work, but they might work only or mostly in BRCA tumors. Let's see what the data said. And we have observed that maybe if we combine this strategy with PI3K inhibitor based on some mechanism of action that I do not want to enter into detail now, maybe we can enhance the activity of both agents.
I'm kind of curious, in a patient who has a triple negative tumor, gets an anthracycline taxane adjuvant regimen, and relapses relatively soon thereafter, what's your usual sequence of therapy after that?
You mean patient with triple negative disease?
Mm-hmm.
So patient who is progressing rapidly after taxane and anthracycline-based therapy in the adjuvant, in the neoadjuvant setting, and she progressed in less than 6 months, this patient, unfortunately, is going to be very, very bad. So I would like to use, and this is something we can do it in Europe, we use bevacizumab to these patients. Bevacizumab is a good drug, in my opinion. We published a meta-analysis regarding toxicity, and we did not observe an important increase in toxicity. So I think that bevacizumab works. And maybe bevacizumab in combination with chemotherapy could be a very good option for these patients. But again, the prognosis of these patients is more or less 1 year or even less.
And just from a practical point of view, what likely chemo agent would you combine with the bevacizumab?
Paclitaxel or capecitabine in general. So if the patient has progressed quickly to paclitaxel, maybe capecitabine plus bevacizumab could be a good option for these patients.
Then what?
Maybe carbogem could be a good option, and afterwards eribulin. If I could have the opportunity to use eribulin, maybe eribulin would be a good option in second line.
Any comments on the ATLAS trial data that was presented at San Antonio, looking at more than 5 years of tamoxifen, and then the ATOM data that was just presented?
Yeah, one of the most important presentations this year at ASCO was the ATOM trial. You know, the ATOM trial compares 5 versus 10 years of tamoxifen, and it is a very interesting trial in combination with the ATLAS trial. So before we thought that 10 years of tamoxifen was less active than 5 years, based mostly in all clinical trials, it was many, many patients were included without knowing the hormone receptor status. So in the ATLAS trial and in the ATOM trial, so what we know is that maybe 10 years of tamoxifen could be a better option compared to 5 years. Moreover, in the ATOM trial, what have been learned this year at ASCO in the plenary session, we have observed the absolute benefit in terms of overall survival of approximately 3%. So I think that for some patients, 10 years of tamoxifen could be a very good option.
What patients specifically would you think about 10 years of tamoxifen, and what about going beyond 5 years of an aromatase inhibitor?
Okay, so the point here is that in postmenopausal women, what we know is that we have to use aromatase inhibitors upfront, after 2-3 years of tamoxifen, or after 5 years of tamoxifen. This is something we do not know, but we have to use them. So I think that I would use 10 years of tamoxifen only in patients who are pre or perimenopausal, because if not, I will use at some time aromatase inhibitors. So maybe patients with high risk endocrine sensitive tumors, premenopausal, perimenopausal, patients with node involvement, I would consider the use of tamoxifen for 10 years. Maybe large tumors, and actually not involvement.